Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We conclude our series of conversations on the ancient world with a conversation on how knowledge from the ancient world has been handed down through the ages, with a specific attention put on the caliphates of medieval times, both in Baghdad and Cordoba, Spain. For this conversation, I'm joined by Violet Mueller. Violet Mueller is a historian and writer who's based in Oxford, England. She has a PhD in intellectual history, and she is the author of a splendid new book called The Map of Knowledge, A Thousand-Year History of How Classical Ideas Were Lost and Found. She joins me via Skype. Violet Mueller, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Hello. Thank you very much, Mitch.
Good to have you. Okay, so you focus on three works of science from the ancient world, and it includes and how they are passed down through the ages. And it includes Euclid's The Elements, that's foundational for geometry, Ptolemy the Almagest, which was very important throughout history for astronomy, and then also Galen's medical writings, sort of the first medical writings that we have had. Tell me why what was so significant for you in these three different pieces of work?
Well, when I started to research the subject, I was interested in the history of science. That was my primary interest. And in the ancient world, there were clearly three areas of science that were the most important, and they were mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. So it just seemed obvious to focus on those three. And then within those three subjects, there were these three great writers, Galen, Ptolemy, and Euclid. And it just seemed they just seemed to be the obvious choice. And part of the reason for that is that they were so successful that not very much survives from before them, because the Elements, if you take the Elements as an example by Euclid, it basically replaced most mathematical texts that it was based on. So they are very clearly the kind of basic texts of those sciences in the ancient world. So I almost didn't have a choice. The choice was made for me.
Interesting. And Euclid's and Ptolemy's and Galen's work, they all go through Alexandria, Egypt, and the Great Library of Alexandria. Tell me why that's significant in the story.
Okay, so Euclid and Ptolemy can be talked about, you know, in kind of the same breath. They were separated by a period of nearly 600 years, but they both lived in Alexandria, and they both wrote their great works on astronomy and maths based on texts that they would have accessed in that library. They're very similar. Also, Ptolemy very much based his work on astronomy on the Elements. And in fact, you cannot study the Almagest unless you have already studied the Elements, because the Elements gives you the geometry that you need in order to then go on. It's the same today. You can't study astronomy if you don't have maths, which I actually discovered at university. I wanted to do a sort of extra astronomy course, and I was never a mathematician. And when I applied for it, they just said, no way, you haven't got the mathematical knowledge. You're not going to be able to get anywhere. So that was those two. Then Galen is a bit different. He did live in Alexandria and studied there as a young man, because at that time it was the only place that you could study human skeletons. And, you know, he was studying medicine. He studied for years and years in all sorts of different places around the Mediterranean. So he was there for a while, but he was mainly studying. I actually don't know if he wrote anything there in particular. But he then went on back to Pergamum, where he came from. And then from there, he went to Rome, and he became, the personal physician of more than one emperor, and spent time in Rome. So he's a slightly different case. Also, he didn't write one big convenient compendium of medicine like the other two did for their subjects. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of books, millions of words, literally. I think many, many more texts by Galen survive from antiquity than any other writer. So I had to kind of be selective and just choose the most important ones. And I focused on the ones which became the basis of the medical education in the Arab world and then later on in Europe as well.
My understanding is with Euclid's The Elements, but Ptolemy's The Almagest, and Galen's in his medical writings, and the ones that you focused on, that of all of those, it's today speaking, it's Euclid's The Elements that still stand the test of time. Again, this is our basis of geometry, where the other ones are a bit outdated. And in fact, Ptolemy's Almagest, which was foundational for astronomy for centuries, had the Earth as the center of the universe. Obviously, that was off a little bit.
Yeah, that's correct. But I think, and it's definitely true, you know, I mean, Euclid's Elements was still being taught as a textbook in schools until, you know, just a few decades ago. And still now, you know, when you learn geometry, you are learning the same thing that is in the Elements. So that has a kind of universality and, I guess, eternal life that that neither Ptolemy nor Galen's theories had. But I think it's very important to see their work as being, you know, they were a stage in the development of how we have discovered about those subjects. And I think in the modern world, we're kind of quite preoccupied by things that are correct and accurate. And actually science, you know, often develops in ways which are unexpected. And, you know, you often have to get a lot wrong before you get something right. Or maybe you even, you know, something goes, an experiment goes wrong, you end up finding out something completely unexpected that you hadn't. And I think that's quite an important thing to remember about science, that, you know, it's not like this straight road towards progress that we're on. And, you know, in that context, yeah, of course, Ptolemy was completely wrong that he thought that the Earth was at the center of the universe. But, you know, his theories played a very important part in getting us to the point where we are now. And, you know, I mean, they were accepted and used as the basis of astronomical investigation for hundreds and hundreds of years. So, but yeah, you're definitely right that, you know, Euclid is the one who has got kind of, you know, he'll last forever and be correct forever.
But what's fascinating about Ptolemy, and again with the Almagest and his work on astronomy, is while, you know, again, he had we call it a geocentric view of the world with the Earth in the middle of the universe. Nonetheless, it worked for that time. It served particular functions for their reality at the time.
Exactly. And it, you know, I mean, we didn't accept, I mean, the idea that the Earth that it was actually a heliocentric universe with the sun at the center and that the Earth was actually just one of the planets was a really, really difficult idea for people to accept. And it took a long time, you know, even after Copernicus, his book was published in 1543, which basically said, look, this is actually wrong. And in fact, you know, the sun is at the center of the universe. It wasn't accepted quickly. You know, it was a very, very, it took a very big mental shift for people to be able to think about their universe in that way. And that's really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think just maybe to put in perspective, if the human species survives another 1,000 years, they'll look back at us today and we think we've got a lot of science figured out. And they'll more than likely look back at us today as getting some fundamental things wrong that we didn't quite understand. And that's probably the way it would. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like perhaps the environment. I mean, I don't know. I think there's a lot that we're getting wrong. That's what I mean by it's a process, isn't it? Of constant sort of of discovery and realization. And I think also now, you know, these days we're very used to having this sort of view. I mean, you know, you know what the Earth looks like from space now, and you know, having those kind of conceptions of things, you know, we're in a completely different position. And I always try and do that when I you know, think about history and when I wrote my book, I really tried to get into the mindset of, you know, Ptolemy, who would have had, I mean, he didn't have a telescope. He didn't have, you know, the instruments that he had in order to take his observations of the heavens and form his theories were so basic compared to what we have now. Yeah, you have to kind of, I think it's important to try and get into the mindset of what it was like, you know, in terms of what was within your power to find out in those days.
And yet he was still able to predict the time of seasons. And, you know, these things are really important for farming during his time. That still worked in his time. It wasn't just theory, yeah, but it was practical. Yeah. Now, again, you take Euclid's The Elements, Ptolemy's The Almagest, and Galen's medical writings, and you follow how they are handed down through history, how we still basically know about these writings today. And what I think maybe we don't think about is how it's almost a miracle that they even got to us at all. Because if we think about, say, 2,000 years ago when these were around, the only way they were handed down is if they were copied by hand. And the things that survived were the things that were actually copied by hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Every single text had to be copied by hand. And of course, the Almagest and the Elements are huge. You know, they're really big books. So it would have been very expensive it would have cost a lot of money to pay someone to make a copy. The writing materials were also expensive. And I think another important thing to remember, which is often overlooked, is that for quite a long time, they would have been scrolls. They wouldn't have been written in actual books because, you know, the book, the codex, as it was called, the originator of what we now call a book, didn't really come into common usage until the sort of 5th century, I would say. When Ptolemy wrote the Almagest, he would have written it on scrolls. He wouldn't have written it in a book. And scrolls were obviously quite, because of the unrolling and rolling them up, they were quite fragile. They had to be recopied probably every 100 years if they were going to survive. Papyrus is also quite, it's a more brittle than paper, and definitely than parchment, which was what sort of took over later on, which is much more durable. Parchment made from animal skins is actually quite strong material. So yes, all these factors meant that, I mean, it was really amazing that these things survived and people kept them safe or, you know, copied them and handed them down to their children. And especially when you think about that in the period after the Roman Empire sort of declined in Western Europe, there was a real period of a couple of centuries where there was a lot of disease and natural disasters and violence, and the life was quite chaotic. And a book is or a scroll is a very, very fragile object in those kind of situations. You know, I mean, what it takes is a fire or, I don't know, an earthquake or... And then they would just be lost forever. So lots of stuff did get lost. We missed out on a lot of things from the ancient world.
The vast majority of it, right? And part of the reason why is because these things just decay and nobody, you know, copies them over and then they're lost. But also purposefully, too, because of the rise of Christianity within the Roman Empire. Would that be accurate?
Yes, definitely. The Christians, certainly in Alexandria, as Christianity rose in power as a sort of force, the problem was that a lot of the libraries in the ancient world were in temples, and so if you take the story of the Serapeum Library, which was the sort of daughter library of the great library at Alexandria, and it was in a temple, and so the Christian mob, when unrest broke out between the Christians, and the pagans, they focused their attentions very much on the temples, and books were obviously destroyed, scrolls were destroyed in the process of that.
This is when we get the murder of the great, one of the few women that you're right that we know of the ancient world, Hypatia, a great mathematician. Yeah. Her father was a great mathematician too. Was his name Theon? He was one of the people that reproduced Euclid's The Elements.
He did, absolutely. Yeah, he was a great writer of commentaries, and he wrote a commentary, I think, on the Elements and also on the Almagest, which were sort of works explaining what they said and sort of to be designed to be read with the original work at the same time, sort of a companion text.
And that's another way these texts survive, is because people throughout the ages would write commentaries on them, and in writing and commentaries on them would also reproduce the actual text.
Exactly. Yeah. So Theon was very important, he produced probably the only famous female scholar in certainly the whole ancient world and sadly most of the medieval world as well. I mean, I really struggled as a feminist to try and find some women to write about, but it's a pretty sad story when it comes to female education.
We've talked about Hypatia on this show before. Are there other women?
Well, there were other women, but they're not. We don't, we know a few names, but there's no other real information about them. And I think, and then in medieval times, of course, there were, certain aristocratic women who were well educated, but none that I can think of who were particularly interested in the sciences and those kind of subjects. But perhaps I haven't done enough research on it. And if anyone can correct me, I'd be so interested to find out.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Violet Mueller, author of the book, The Map of Knowledge, A Thousand-Year History of How Classical Ideas Were Lost and Found. I really wanted to focus on the Islamic caliphates between the 8th century and I guess 15th century, first first in Baghdad and then in Cordoba. And I think what's important to understand here is partially, again, with the rise of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire and especially in Western Europe, in the Western Roman Empire, you had the emphasis on religious writings. Now the writings that were being duplicated, again, it had to be done by hands. Really important to remember, are religious writings. But on the former eastern part of the empire, and this comes from the Byzantium Empire, but then again, the caliphates beginning within the Eighth Empire, they are able to keep these, not only these writings alive, but these intellectual traditions alive. How did they do that?
Well, I think especially in Syria, that was a great center of where these books were taken, and they were translated into Syriac, which was the language of the Christian church in that part of the world, in the Middle East. Because before the Arabs arrived, there were more Christians in that part of the world than anywhere else. So obviously, that's where Christianity originated. As you say, it was within a sort of church setting, but there were still people who were Christians and were bishops or whatever, but they still were interested in scientific subjects and maths and that kind of thing. And they for them there wasn't a conflict, or at least not a conflict that they allowed to bother them, between the scientific text and the sort of religious aspect of their lives. For Christians, there was quite an impetus to study astronomy and basic maths, because they had to work out the date of Easter every year, and that involved knowing when the vernal equinox was, and they had to, in order to find that out, they had to, that was astronomical information. So that was a kind of driver for that. Medicine is, everyone always needed medicine. They always needed to be cured from disease. So I think Galen's writings were in a slightly different position to Ptolemy and Euclid, insofar as, not all of his writings, obviously, because he wrote way too much, but the sort of really practical books, the books that could really help with healing and diagnosis, were definitely shared and recopied. And were often in monasteries or churches because they were so useful for the local community. So I think that's kind of how that happened. And then in Byzantium, in what is now Constantinople, Istanbul, there were big libraries, which were sort of repositories for a lot of these books. There wasn't a lot of original scientific study going on there, but they did. It was a great center of preservation. And it's definitely a place that when the Abbasid caliphs in Baghdad began to look for these books, Constantinople was one of the places where they, they wrote to the emperor and asked if he could send them books because they knew that they were in existence in that city.
Who were the Abbasids?
They were an Arab tribe who were related in some way to Muhammad. I can't completely remember how. And they rose to power in the 8th century. And they used... By that stage, the Muslim empire grew incredibly quickly, and they conquered this enormous expanse in a very short period of time. And the initial dynasty were the Umayyads, and this sort of rival tribe of the Abbasids had a lot of power up in this province called Khwarazm, which is sort of right up near in modern day Kazakhstan and in that kind of area, and they rose using the people up. They'd conquered a lot of land, they had a lot of support, and they sort of rose up and threw the Umayyads out of power and seized the caliphate from them.
And this is where, again, you'd see the fire of learning take hold in Baghdad in the 7th century, beginning with Al-Mansur, one of the early leaders of the Abbasids. And then he would create the Al-Mansur Mosque. And in this mosque, what's important, I think, to understand is it also served as a library and a place of scholarship.
Yeah, so it's a similar story with, pagan temples were always centers of education and where books were often kept. And of course, the same with the Christian church. For a long time in the medieval period, the only place you could learn to read and write in Europe was in a monastery or in a sort of church setting. And it was very similar in with Islam. There were sort of schools attached to mosques, and they would have had collections of books, and teachers would have, they would have been teaching there. Initially, they would have been teaching children to read and write and, to be able to read the Quran. But obviously that extended way beyond that, depending on, who was there and what they were interested in.
And I think something important to understand is, and we hear this today, where Islam has respect for people of the book. And when we hear that, we think people of the book, meaning the Old Testament, the New Testament, and obviously the Quran, which is the Quran is a part of that religious tradition. But back in this time of the caliphates in the 8th century onward, there was also great enthusiasm not just for those books, but all books, and that it was a part of Islam and for intellectual inquiry, for scientific inquiry, discovering the world for them also meant discovering Allah. It was congruent with religious practice.
It was at certain times in certain places, that is true. And there were different, sort of philosophies that were followed and religious traditions. It's very complicated. It varied very much from place to place. And there were a lot of sort of variations and, differences of opinion. But certainly in Baghdad in the 8th and 9th centuries, they considered, led by many of these caliphs, they considered that learning, like as you said, learning about the sort of the great book of nature was a way of coming to God and praising God. And that was one of the drivers behind all these incredible things which they discovered and studied and tried to find out.
Can you tell me about what we call the House of Wisdom? What was that within the Abbasid Caliphate?
Oh, I wish I knew more about the House of Wisdom, but the problem is that it's really just a name. No one is even sure if it actually existed as a physical place or whether it was perhaps a sort of an idea. But it is referred to, and you know, it's quite possible that in the palace they had a big library which was called the House of Wisdom. But there are, you know what historians are like. Some historians today argue that, you know, it never existed and, you know, we can't. But it's really emblematic of the, just the incredible feeling of possibility that must have existed in Baghdad in those times, you know, of just scholars and people interested in things and this just sort of wonderful feeling that of intellectual flowering and discovery that was going on. But sadly, there is no actual physical evidence for it. And there isn't even anything. I mean, it's referred to in sources, but it's never described. So one of the things I tried to do in my book was to try and kind of read about other similar libraries around the same time and imagine how, you know, what it would have been, you know, what it would have been like. But it certainly, I think, is in a tradition of, you know, of following in the footsteps of the Library of Alexandria, in that it's a place where scholars can come and there's a lot of resources and they can share their knowledge in an atmosphere of tolerance and enlightenment.
The Abbasid Caliphate was large. It was a large empire. And I think what was unique about what was happening within, and Baghdad's the center of it, and what's happening in Baghdad in this period of time, is that on one hand, they are bringing and keeping alive the knowledge that you found in the ancient Western classical world from Greece and also from Rome. But then to the east of it, it is also bringing ancient knowledge from India, from Persia, and sort of mending it all together. And what I found really interesting was what they did with Indian knowledge. Can you tell me about what was called the Siddhanta by Brahmagupta?
Yes. Well, that's how we got our numbers. I mean, our system of numbers, that they came from India and possibly even China before that. And this very poetic, complex astronomical text came to Baghdad at some point. No one is quite sure why, when, called the Siddhanta. And some poor scholar was set to translate it. And goodness knows how he managed to do that, because it's, as I say, it's all written in poetic language. So it's not like Euclid's Elements, which is so absolutely clear. And
so it's not
basic.
Straightforward.
Not at all.
It's math within poetic prose.
No, the meaning is kind of, you know, bound up in very flowery language. So anyway, they managed to translate it. And I think ideas were coming anyway, you know, that there's the whole influence of the Silk Routes, which Baghdad was obviously, you know, such a centrally positioned place when it came to the East and the West. And, you know, everything sort of came through the city because it was became such a hub. And so these ideas from India and specifically the whole concept of having a system of numbers which goes from 1 to 9 and then there's a 0. So you can, using just those digits, you can write any number, you know, you can keep on going. And I'm not a mathematician at all. And I hadn't ever really thought about it until I did the research for this book. And my husband is a mathematician. He's a math teacher. And so I kind of went in to say to him, this is amazing. I don't know. I'd never appreciated how clever that system is, if you think about it. So there was an incredible scholar in Baghdad called Al-Khwarizmi, who, we should all know his name. I mean, without him, we would have I don't know, he was just amazing. And he then read about, you know, whether he read the Siddhanta in translation. And then he wrote a text of his own about this number system, just saying, you know, this is amazing. This is what we should all be using. Because at that point, they were using, you know, some people were using Roman numerals. And I don't know if you've ever tried to add, you know, a sum using Roman numerals, but it's so difficult. There's no way mathematics would have been able to develop in the way that it has, I don't think, if we just had Roman numerals. Other people were using the Babylonian system, which is based on 60. It's a base 60 system. So that's where we get our time. That's why there's 60 minutes in an hour and so on. Anyway, so Al-Khwarizmi said, you know, we should be using this system that's based on 10. It's just so much simpler and so much better. But of course, you know, like with Copernicus is changing around the universe, people were not keen on making this enormous change quickly. So it took a really, really long time before the so-called Hindu Arabic numerals that we all use today, every day, all the time, were actually accepted and came into common usage. But that's one of my favorite stories in the book. I just think that's incredible.
It is an incredible story. Let's stay with it, because this is the birth of algebra, isn't it? Which is an Arabic term.
That was another book that Al-Khwarizmi wrote, which was called the Algebra, and that's where the word algebra comes from. And he identified, I think, four of the... I'm not sure. I mean, he identified a whole load of equations and quadratic equations. And it was the sort of foundation text on algebra, basically. And we have him to thank for that. And we also, the word algorithm comes from his name, because when his name was Latinized, Latin writers wrote it as algorithmus or algorithmus. So that's where the word algorithm comes from.
Is this where the notion of algorithm also comes from, or just the word algorithm that is reused later on for what we think of today with computers?
I think, yeah, that, you know, as part of his work on algebra, came up with the idea of making these universal phrases which could be applied to many different types of mathematical problem. That was one of the things that he did, was instead of just looking at a specific problem, he was talking about finding solutions which could be applied universally to all different problems. So yes, I think in its most basic form, that exactly, it was the idea as well as the name.
And this is how I see it, and this is what I see about the beauty of Baghdad in the 8th, 9th, and 10th century. And the Abbasids actually renamed Baghdad in Arabic to City of Peace. Baghdad, I believe, was actually the Persian name before them. But what I find the beauty of this period of time of being is, on one hand, they keep alive the traditions of Euclid and geometry. And then on the other hand, and maybe on the other side of this empire, they're bringing the knowledge from India, again, the Siddhanta written by Brahmagupta, and bringing it all together into something brand new, which for me, I am very tempted to say, would be the birth of the modern world that we see with the work of Musa al-Khwarizmi.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most striking things that I learned from writing this book, is that, you know, that Euclid, it was the same story with Euclid. He didn't just use one tradition when he wrote the Elements. He was using all sorts of, you know, Egyptian, Babylonian, the same with Ptolemy. He was using data that was Babylonian. So I think this idea that our culture is somehow has always been Western and has always been from this very narrow, you know, single kind of tradition it's just so wrong. And of course, it makes sense that when you combine the best ideas from all sorts of different traditions and places, and you combine them and make, you know, of course, you're going to get something which is much more exciting and I mean, it just sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
In Western history, we usually look at it beginning with ancient Greece and Athens, birth of democracy. then you get Rome, ancient Rome versus Republic, transitions into an empire. And then we get, as we would call it, the Dark Ages, which is just this about 1,000-year period of time in which not a whole lot other than Christianity is happening. And then miraculously, the Renaissance, the rediscovery of the ancient world that would lead to the Renaissance. And then after that, the birth of the scientific method. And then after that, the Enlightenment and so on and so on. What is always left out is what the Islamic caliphates did. And we've been talking about the Abbasid caliphate, but there's another important caliphate to talk about that as well. And you've mentioned it a few times, the Umayyad caliphate, that would actually bring this knowledge back to Europe through Spain. Tell me about what's important to know about the Umayyads and Spain in this narrative.
Well, the first thing is the story of how they got there. It's the most amazing story. So when the Abbasids, did their coup, the story goes, I don't know, who knows how accurate it is, but the story goes that they literally murdered every single Umayyad they could find because they wanted to stamp them out. And there's this very evocative description of this one prince called Rahman who managed to escape with one his servants, and they literally swam across the river to get away from the Abbasid troops, and very dramatic. And then they spent years wandering in the deserts of Egypt and had all these adventures, and there's a story of how he nearly got captured by someone, but he managed to hide under a pile of clothes in the chieftain's wife's bedroom. I mean, what he was doing in the chieftain's wife's bedroom, we don't know. That probably wasn't a very sensible place to be. But anyway, he survived, and he made it right the way across North Africa to Morocco because his mother had been a Berber princess, and that's where the Berber tribes originated from. So he managed to get back there, where he kind of, made contact with some of his relations through on his mother's side. And then Spain had been conquered a couple of decades before by various Arab tribes in collaboration with Berber tribes. And so he set off for Spain and, conquered the whole thing himself. And because of who he was, he had this kind of magical aura about him. He was, he was the Umayyad who'd survived, and he'd made this incredible journey, and there he was, and he was going to be the leader. And he founded a dynasty. And initially they were sort of nominally underneath the Abbasid caliphate, because the Abbasids held the caliphate. So they were just emirs, and they were sort of in theory supposed to be subordinate to the Abbasids. But you can imagine that was always quite a tricky situation to negotiate. And after 100 years or so, they became more and more powerful, and then they declared a rival caliphate of their own, and they had this capital city at Cordoba in Spain, which is one of the most incredible places that I went to during my research. And I don't know if it's the same in the States, but everyone in England has been to Florence and Venice and all those Italian cities, and places like Cordoba and Toledo, I don't know, people just don't seem to visit them. They don't seem to be on the sort of tourist map so much. So, anyone who's listening, who's thinking about going on a trip to Spain, go to Cordoba. I haven't been to Seville. Apparently, that's even more incredible, and Granada. They had this incredible civilization, and they founded great libraries. And Cordoba it's still a very, very beautiful city. It's got it's very famous for its gardens and fountains and little courtyards with running water. And it's a very atmospheric place. So the Umayyads had their sort of second life, as it were, in Spain, and were a very successful dynasty for a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, and then you had the Moorish rulers of Spain for 700 years before there was even a Spain, before Spain even existed. And this is important to understand, because this is how you get the algebra that comes to Europe. This is how you get a lot of knowledge that had already been lost to Europe from Greece and from the Roman Empire. But this is also how you get and I forgot to mention this, paper comes to Europe as well, because the caliphates got it from China. And then other things, including the game of chess, would come through this from India, maybe even Persia, but from India to the to these Arab caliphates to Europe.
Yes, and also lots and lots of food, because the other great thing that the Arabs did was introduce irrigation to all these places, because obviously they, you know, coming from the deserts, they were experts in how to make stuff grow when there's not very much water. And because they had conquered such a huge area, you know, they went to India and they took aubergines and all these exotic plants, which, you know, hadn't been seen before. And they took them and spread them around their whole empire. So they vastly improved the agricultural and the food, the agriculture and the food of the places that they settled in. And Spain was absolutely one of those places, as you say. And I think today something like, I shouldn't put a number on it, but most words in Spanish which are connected with irrigation come from Arabic.
Yeah, I believe almost a quarter of Spanish vocabulary comes from Arabic. Almost every word that begins with A comes from Arabic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lived in...
Years, you know, 700 years.
Yeah.
Spain was under Muslim rule. I mean, it's you know, and it just doesn't seem to me to be something that people really know about. I don't know. Maybe it's me being ignorant, but it doesn't seem something that's... I don't know. I think especially in today's world, we just really should focus more on the stuff that connects us and the stuff we have in common and our shared heritage, of which there is so much. I think that it would just be better rather than always focusing on the things that make us different.
I lived in Mexico many years ago in an old colonial town built by the Spanish called Querétaro. And I remember just going above and looking down upon this old colonial town. It has its modern areas now, obviously, but the old architecture, and just thinking to myself, goodness, this looks Islamic to me. I almost feel like I'm in Morocco. And the Muslims would bring architecture to Spain too.
Well, it would have been Islamic. It would have been taken from, because that's the one thing that did get left behind in Spain is the architecture, and there is still the Alhambra and, you know, these palaces in Seville, because the manuscripts, the books were destroyed. You know, they were burned. There was this appalling moment in Granada, which was the last city to be conquered, and they sent a very hardline cleric down to kind of, you know, convert anyone who was left or get rid of any Muslims who wouldn't convert. And he collected every book in Arabic he could find in the city, and he put them in a pile in the central square, and he set them on fire. And by the 17th century, there was literally a handful of Arabic manuscripts left in Spain, which shows you how successful that policy was of just kind of silencing a whole, you know, civilization. It's really sad.
How fanaticism works.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, religion, I don't know. As a historian of science, I do try and keep an open mind about religion and try and... But there's just so many instances from especially medieval history where religion just didn't play a positive role when it came to the pursuit of knowledge or being open-minded and tolerant. I don't know.
And Arabic, the language, is important to understand during this period of time because, again, when we think of ancient history, and if you think of the Roman Empire, everyone, at least the elite, the aristocracy, the learned aristocracy, all spoke Greek. And so Greek was the language of education. But during this period of time, between, I guess, the 8th and, you know, 14th century, Arabic is the language of education, of learning.
Yes, it is. And there's a brilliant quote, which is in my book. I can't remember it off by heart, but that there was a cleric, a Christian in Cordoba, and he writes this, you know, he's a sort of grumpy old man, and he's complaining about all the young Christians because they all want to learn Arabic and they're all forgetting their Latin. And of course they are. I mean, but at that stage in Spain, you know, if Arabic was the language of the future. It was the language of science. It was the language of, you know, if you wanted to get on or do anything, it was, all these books were coming in from the Arab world in Arabic, you know, and Latin culture had completely stagnated. So of course, all the young people, all the ambitious young men were wanting to learn Arabic so they could have access to all these riches. Totally understandable.
And Toledo, you mentioned Toledo earlier in modern-day Spain, is important because this is where the translation from Arabic into Latin was happening. And you write about one individual in particular, I hope you tell me about, his name being Gerard.
Yeah, Gerard of Cremona, who was this extraordinary young man. He was very interested in astronomy, and he, you know, grew up in northern Italy and learned everything he could. And he heard about the Almagest, and he heard that there might well be a copy of it in Toledo in Spain. So off he set on his journey. Goodness knows how he even got there, how he even knew where to go. But he arrived in Toledo and found a copy of the Almagest, because Toledo had been captured by the Christian forces from the north, the European forces. And it was quite a peaceful handover. So a lot of the libraries just remained intact. So there were all these libraries full of Arabic books in the city. And Gerard wasn't the only young European scholar to make the journey, but he was definitely the one who made the most impact. He arrived, he got his copy of the Almagest. You can imagine him sitting with it in front of him at the desk, very excited. And he opened it up, and of course it was in Arabic, and he couldn't speak Arabic, so he couldn't begin to understand it. But, you know, he got that far. He traveled all the way from Cremona in Italy. So he just learned Arabic fluently. And he went on to translate more books into Latin than any other single person. He was the most important sort of channel between the Arabic civilization and the Latin Christian civilization. And he... You know, he doesn't come across as a very, I mean, I think if you'd met him, he would have been quite a dry person, but he had the most incredible work ethic. I mean, he translated, I think, nearly 100 books in his lifetime. And, you know, these are not small books. These are really big, complex works of science and medicine. And he just devoted the rest of his life to doing that. And as far as we know, he never went back to Italy. And many of his translations were then, taken and disseminated in Europe, and, you know, became the basis of the first printed editions of these books and that kind of thing. So he was really, really, really important.
We're almost out of time, and I really did want to focus and very much appreciate you helping me focus on the Islamic caliphates. I do want to end with this. I think it's important to know. We don't get the Renaissance without this, do we?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. It's all linked. It's all, you know, all these things are connected to one another. And you know, each new generation of scholars who discover things and translate texts, they all rely on the generations that have gone before. And that's just how it is. But no, we wouldn't. And you know, there was this thing called the 12th century Renaissance, which is, I think it's a bit silly to keep calling things Renaissance. I mean, you know, they talk about an English Renaissance in the 16th century. You can't be reborn if you haven't been born in the first place. And we'd never had these ideas in England, really. It's only really Italy, I think, where you can talk about a Renaissance. And when it comes to science, the Romans weren't very interested in science anyway. So... I don't know. I have a bit of an issue with that whole term. But no, you certainly wouldn't have had, you know, we wouldn't be where we are today without the work of all these scholars in the Middle Ages, I don't think.
Yeah. No, I'm convinced after going through your book, this is sort of, I think this is the argument. Everyone has an argument for the birth of the modern world. But this one's mine with these Islamic caliphates, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, everyone should know Al-Khwarizmi's name. That's my main takeaway point from my book, I think.
Violet Mueller has been our guest again. She is the author of the book called The Map of Knowledge, A Thousand-Year History of How Classical Ideas Were Lost and Found. Violet Muller, I have enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Me too. Thank you very much, Mitch.